It's the Wonky Show. There's a government support package for universities and students, but is it a bailout? That's the question we'll ask. There's a new registration condition that OFS is consulting on, at least for providers in England. And we'll also think through the politics of all this and where all of this goes next. It's all coming up.
And what this does, I think, is a really pernicious thing, which is kind of separate out universities from the people who benefit from them. The students that go primarily, but also the communities and local regional economies. And so many.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Jim Dickinson up in the attic, and it's government support package for universities and students time. Hooray! The question is it a bailout? Will it work? It's very late on a Sunday night. And with me are Mark and Debbie and DK from the team. Quite informal. Debbie, lead us off. What's in the package?
Right. So what's in the bailout? It's not a bailout. No. And actually, I mean, of course, that is the key takeaway. It's not a bailout. There's no new money here. There's been some restructuring of the timing on which existing funding has been it will be allocated to the sector. So there's 100 million in quality related research funding, which of course is the funding that comes in as a result of the REF, and that will be brought forward to this year. So that was already in the pipeline, and universities are going to get it up front with the hope that that will kind of smooth out issues around research. And the expectation is that tuition fees will be paid up front in the autumn. So rather than getting 25% in September, universities will be able to get more than that. And this is being billed as a sort of £2.6 billion in bailout equivalent. But of course, that rather depends on the student showing up in the first place. There's money for students in the sense that the Office for Students has clarified that the Student Premium Fund, which is allowed to be used for student financial support, and if universities reallocate funding from their access and participation plans that may have been allocated elsewhere, if they do that with good reason, then the Office for Students will not mind. And there's also some working groups. So on some of the trickier issues, research sustainability, there'll be a working group on that, and another on international recruitment to look at what measures the government might take as part of its international education strategy to lure international students back to the UK in wake of COVID-19. And there's a few things that were really already in hand but are being sort of billed as part of this bailout. So, for example, DfE has noted that there's a sum of money in this year's budget that is earmarked for buying land to enable new schools, and this is something that, you know, universities may benefit from should they have land available. And with all this comes some strings. So Universities UK asked for a student number control to be set across the whole sector at +5% of forecast numbers for the academic year 2020-21, and that is expected to be implemented. And there is a whole bunch of conditions designed to stabilise admissions and kind of dampen the effects of the market, which OFS has put out a parallel consultation on, and we will discuss in due course.
Well, fascinating. Now, DK, Gavin Williamson, when he appeared in front of the Education Committee this week, set some tests, didn't he?
Well, they weren't quite tests. They were aspirations. They were what he wanted for the sector. He was quite careful not to phrase them as tests, but let's face it, they were tests. So what he was looking for: stability for students, safeguarding research resources, and recognising the role providers play in the local communities. Of course, all of those depend on providers actually continuing to exist so they can have research resources, offer student stabilities, and play a role in local communities. So I think we can add that as like an overarching structure here.
Interesting, DK. Right. So let's start then by getting some hot takes. Mark?
Well, the big thing for me is whether or not this is a bailout, and clearly it isn't. There are plenty of support measures that the sector have been asking for, like student number controls, all with some major strings. And the killer for me is the fact that it's not new money. And this speaks to me of the disagreement in government at the moment, perhaps even in the sector at the scale of the problem. So the fact that there's no new money announced is basically bringing forward payments that were going to be made throughout next year, and possibly with the hint of some extra things like that land fund that Debbie talked about. But it's not, you know, not significant bunches of cash. It tells me that the Treasury isn't ready to spend money to save higher education, full stop. And looking at what the sector's asked for in the first place, which is what's taken us to this package, perhaps many in the sector don't fully understand the scale of the problem, one that's probably going to span multi-year and will have a huge and differential impact across different sorts of universities. So we've been writing now for several weeks on the site about the number cap and the model that's being implemented now, likely to benefit the top, you know, the top most famous elite universities most able to recruit students at the expense of the weakest. I'm not sure that's the intention of the government, but that's probably what we're looking at. So this isn't a sector-wide bailout. It's a measures to kind of keep things on the road, a direction of travel. But there's a huge barrier or a mountain to climb, even with the Treasury, where universities are going to need billions and billions of taxpayers' money to survive. It's just the bottom line. Or the government has to make a decision that's not what they're going to do at all. And we're going to have these kind of measures re-announced and repackaged until, you know, a third of the sector collapses in 12 months' time.
Now, I mean, before we move on and get some more takes, let's do a bit of devil's advocate. So one of the things the press release says is that OFS has estimated that in England, the value of the support packages, you know, the wider support packages for the rest of the economy that universities could take advantage of, could be worth 700 million. That's 700 million of new money, Mark.
And in the meantime, we've got a working group to look at how, you know, the worst effects of international students not coming to the UK on the government's international education strategy, it says. So it's not even a working group to look at how to prop up providers who've lost 25% of their income by this coming September. It's just the position of perhaps the, you know, the UK and its international education export industry, which I hate to break it to anyone tuning in this week, is not in the best of shape.
What jumps out at me is it's the kind of, I guess, the lack of acknowledgement of the possibility that students might not come in September. And of course, we're not talking all students, and different students have different drivers and different kind of contexts that are going to influence that decision. But, you know, to be able to say confidently that universities are getting £2.6 billion in support, when that is basically a calculation on the assumption that universities will all be recruiting not only what they've got this year, but plus 5%, in a situation where it's really not clear whether what's on offer, it's just really not clear what's on offer to students. And there's nothing in the package that would particularly give students confidence that they, you know, not only will they have some, you know, be offered something that is of a decent quality and kind of that matches their aspirations, but that that will be able to kind of mitigate any kind of financial issues that they and their families will be facing as a result of COVID-19. You know, it just seems very sanguine. And of course, there's always a possibility that, you know, come September, should the situation change, you know, as data emerges over the summer, that you know, that students are kind of less inclined to come, that may change the calculation on the part of the government. But, you know, even, you know, sort of, you know, UCAS figures sort of seem to suggest that, you know, 86% of students at this time have said, oh, well, we think we'll probably go to university. You know, these are students, those are prospective students who have already applied. And even if that remains true, which is, you know, it's a very good number, there's still 14% who are saying, well, actually, no, I'm thinking I might change my plans. So, you know, it's not, none of this is a given. it's a concern.
But you say that, Debbie. So one of the things the press release says is the government expects, and that's quite an interesting, you know, word if nothing else, the government expects access to the business support schemes, the reprofiling of public funding and the student number control, added all up, to be sufficient to help stabilise most providers' finances. Yeah, you know, one of the questions I guess must be, you know, can we see your workings out?
Yes, please. I'd love to see the workings out. Let's be blunt. It's not. There is absolutely no way in hell. The big spending amount, the 2.6 million of reprofiled funds, coincidentally a little bit bigger than the 2.5 billion that the London Economics Report was talking about last week, is money that universities were going to get anyway. They'd budgeted for it in January and in May of next year. So it's not actually, it would be a great bailout if universities were facing an immediate cash flow problem, but that's not the issue. And I think this is where the problem lies. The the Treasury, it seems to me, are used at the moment, are used to chucking money at things that are going to collapse imminently, like in the next day or so. Like, we're not actually going to have a logistics industry. We're not actually going to have any shops. So that is the kind of profile of risk that they're dealing with, like, right now. And they're dealing with it in the only way they can, which is to chuck loads and loads and loads of money at it. The problem universities are facing is right at the moment, they're not really facing a cash flow problem. Universities are still going to be functional tomorrow and next week and next month. So that is not the kind of risk that is turning on the Treasury taps. Instead, we're going to have to wait till September, October. We're going to have to wait until the crisis actually hits and universities are starting to panic and lay things off and sell random bits of land. And then I suspect we're going to get the actual bailout. We're going to get something that is actually going to make a difference to that immediate point. It's particularly stupid because if we did something now, like, I mean, I actually posted a bailout plan on the site on Friday lunchtime that involves actually avoiding a lot of the risk by deferring the start of the year to January 2020, running admissions as normal, and just covering the salary costs as a loan in the meantime. Now, I'm not necessarily a person to blow my own trumpet, but if we chose to do that now for the sector, that would fix all of these problems in the short to medium term. At the moment, we've not got anything that is really going to fix anything.
I think you have to ask how bad are things going to get before a bigger bailout comes. And Jim hinted at it in the press release that we've all been sent on Sunday evening. It says that the support package that's been announced should be sufficient, along with the rest of the government's wider support, the furlough scheme and the business interruption scheme and all of that. And then talk of really kind of provider by provider questions. So it mentions a restructuring scheme for universities. And it seems to me, if we read between the lines, that the government is saying right now, this is it. There isn't going to be a bailout of higher education. This is what you're getting. We've announced wider help for the economy, which you're part of. But if individual universities face collapse, then we're going to look at those situations on a kind of case-by-case basis, see whether it's something we want to survive, and look at the strings attached to any kind of individual bailout question. I could quite well see that line being held for some time. I think this does depend, though, on just how bad things are come September. And if we're looking at essentially zero international students coming to the UK, I think the numbers that UK and the rest of the sector will go to the Treasury with will start to look that much more stark. And I think bringing forward that student loan payment, the 25%, is some help, but it's not new money that you can plan to continue to run your university for the next year. And what about the students already in years 2 and 3 and beyond? And what about the recruitment cycle for 2022? What are you meant to do? How are you meant to promise that you can provide anything really when you're not at all convinced that you're going to survive as a going concern?
Well, I mean, let's have a look. Let's try and look in some order about whether or not we think that the measures that are there may work or not. Now, clearly we don't know how many people are going to turn up in September. There are still these really big questions about how many will defer, how many people will be allowed to come from other countries, what home demand will look like, which is moderately under-researched at this point. But let's try and work through with some with some order. DK, can you just explain the potential problem with the forecast plus 5% student number control?
So this is something that there's an article by Mark Corver on the site that kind of dives into this beautifully, in that the problem with number controls is it assumes a normal pattern of applicant behaviour. So it basically assumes people are applying to and will accept places from the places that they would have done so anyway had this just been a normal year. Now, this is a gamble. This is a risk. If you start looking at applicant behaviour doing something kind of slightly different, I mean, Mark Corver looked at the possibility of students wanting to stay at home. I've looked on the site in other articles at the possibility of students all wanted to pile into the Russell Group or the high tariff provider, which is the kind of risk everybody seems to be focused on, it becomes quite difficult to see a way in which those caps are low enough to make an appreciable difference to student demand. I mean, to put the forecast plus 5% into perspective, the forecasts that providers give OFS are legendarily way, way over the top. We've been over this a few times on the site. And then to add an extra 5% of growth when for the last couple of years we've seen something like 1.5% growth year on year, and that we're still in the environment where the number of 18-year-olds are going down. I think we hit the bottom of the trough this year, and then it's going up after that. It seems very, very unlikely that we're going to get that. It's likely there'll be less students overall. Some students might just want to defer entirely and get what they see as the proper university experience. Some students, because of local issues or concerns about their family, might elect to defer a year to do something to support their community or family. I think student numbers are going to go down overall, and that adds even more volatility into this system. So as far as we can tell from the research we've done, the cap is actually going to make things more volatile rather than less. And that's before even that we move into looking at the raw excitement that is Clearing Plus that we'll get to in a moment.
And Debbie, this is part of the problem, isn't it? Because if you've got a mechanism that's about sharing out the pain, you probably need to know with a reasonable guess how much pain there will be before you design the mechanism, don't you?
Yes. Well, I mean, yes, this point has been made many times on the site. And I mean, I think, well, something Gavin Conlon at London Economics has said is that there's no point having a plus five cap unless you've got a minus five as well. So you basically put a kind of a lower threshold below which either, I suppose, you guarantee the income as government, or you, I'm not sure what you do, kind of frog march students to the university.
It's the old tolerance band thing that you, it's the income. It's like, I mean, Hefke used to do back in the day, if you were kind of 5% down, you still get the money that you would have got.
And I'm really disappointed to know, DK, that it's not that the government was actually going to go around and knock on 18-year-olds' doors and, you know, put masks on them and insist that they attend university.
Again, we will probably get to you to Clearing Plus later on.
But this is, yeah, but this is the, this has been the question all along, really, is that, and demand is so enormously unpredictable this year. And of course, you know, we hope that many students will wish to attend university nonetheless. And we hope also that what is on offer for them will be sufficient for them to continue to attend university. And of course, there may be some canny students who think to themselves, well, actually, if I defer next year, and lots of people do that too, then next year is going to be very difficult to get into university. And so I might as well do it this year, although you'd have to have quite a lot of foresight. I think actually one of the kind of downsides of this package, and I think, you know, we really should caveat everything we're saying by sort of saying there are sort of enormous demands on government right now. And it's been notable that lots of universities have been extremely emollient in their, you know, university representative bodies have been extremely emollient in their response to this package, saying it's very welcome and very positive step forward and that sort of thing. But it does also rule out the possibility of large scale compensatory measures, like, for example, a January start. It basically kind of asserts the status quo without, you know, and attaches quite a lot of conditions to maintaining the status quo, specifically that universities not behave in the competitive way that they've been encouraged to do so for the last decade, while not really kind of making the status quo, you know, not necessarily basing it on data that would give everyone confidence that the status quo is the best thing for the sector.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I should probably take a couple of minutes to explain this other thing that is in the mix, shouldn't I? This new OFS registration condition. So, the headline about kind of trying to reduce competitive behaviours is the student number control. But there's something else in the mix. So officially, this morning, if you're listening to this on Monday the 4th, officially OFS is out consulting this morning on a new temporary condition of registration in the management and governance basket, E6. for conditions of registration fans. And what this does is rule out and ban conduct that could reasonably have a material negative effect on the interests of students and the stability and or integrity of all or part of the English higher education sector. And I think what I would say is, if that sounds amazingly wide and open to all sorts of interpretation, that's because it's amazingly wide and open to all sorts of interpretation. And you look, what OFS is getting at here is that effectively what it's saying is, whilst the student number control can do something around the kind of English undergraduate market, it doesn't deal with, you know, PGT or suddenly turning round to international students and dropping your English language requirements or all of the other things that you might do that might put, you know, might destabilise the sector. It doesn't cover, you know, taking out, getting your people on your phone banks to start bad-mouthing the university up the road for its online provision. So it doesn't cover all sorts of what the press or Damien Hines in the olden days or OFS have always called some of the bad behaviours in the market. So it's designed this temporary registration condition. Officially, the words are what I said a few minutes ago. And then there are, as ever with the regulatory framework, examples of bad behaviour. And the examples include conditional unconditional offers. So they basically just get banned. Making lots of unconditional offers in general or lots of low offers. You know, the sort of offers that pretend not to be unconditional but really are because they're so low.
Like the famous Oxford 2E offer, of course.
Absolutely, yeah. Offering gifts or discounts designed to attract students away from their original choices. So, here, do you want an iPad? Making false or misleading statements about someone else. Financial support packages made available by the government for purposes that don't serve the interests of or of the public. So taking a load of money and paying your VC a fat salary or something, I don't know. Failing to secure the standard of qualifications awarded to... One of the things about lots of these things is I thought lots of these things were already banned. And so, you know...
Oh, this bans them more, though.
This bans them... What, this bans them more?
No, we definitely don't want any of that behaviour.
Of course, the other way of reading it is that this is a really quite deep and significant attack on the autonomy of institutions. Now, if you're the sort of person that says, nothing wrong with unconditional offers, they give people lots of safety and security, they're a morally good thing to do, you know, they take stress off students, you know, and so on and so on, you can understand, you know, that what you're likely to say, this is a terrible attack on your autonomy. If you're the sort of person that says, oh my God, all these unconditional offers are bums on seats, outrages that aren't in the best interest of students and manipulate people with dodgy sales behaviour, this is great news. Now, to some extent, those two positions have been kind of held in flux for a while. what this does is say, no, pick it aside. And the list of kind of banned behaviours, you imagine, were brainstormed one day in the admissions review that OFS has now paused as all of the worst things anyone could ever do. Every front page of, you know, every, you know, broadsheet ever of all the naughty things that people could do inside a market.
There's nothing on grade inflation, to be fair.
yeah, to be fair, grade inflation is missing. And I then kind of listed, and so then you end up with OFS kind of giving itself, and let's be clear, it will end up giving itself the power, not just giving itself the power, but also the power to backdate that power with an extraordinary set of words that allows it to somehow turn the clock back to March the 11th, even though people have already given out offers. What this does then is significantly extend all of that power, explicitly says we are going to set aside institutional autonomy because students' interests aren't served by it at this point. And the big question for the sector will be, is this the hill we die on right now? In this room, with this crisis, in relation to our autonomy around offer making, that will be a tough one when people are writing their consultation responses.
Well, the surprising thing in some ways is that the consultation is happening at all, because what are they going to do? Say, oh, well, people really don't like this. We're just... as it turns out, people, and we are in unprecedented times, but it does rather expose. Hey. Drink. But it does rather expose the kind of the consultation process I've never been especially convinced that. I think all the responses probably get read. I don't think they get acted upon as a rule, and I very much doubt that in this instance there's going to be the blindest bit of notice paid to them. Maybe I'm wrong about that, and maybe the kind of premise that something may have been missed or something may not have been considered holds true now as it did before. But I mean, of course, the other kind of important thing to remember holds true here, which is that once you've given away power, it's awfully difficult to get it back.
There is a sunset clause, of course.
Government surveillance and regulatory intervention.
Yeah, I mean, they have got this thing that they need to do another consultation if they want to extend it after a year. Again, your comments on consultations are well-founded, although I think there are often some instances of good quality regulatory consultations. It's not often, especially with stuff like this, that a provider is going to get a free choice. But I mean, like you, I'm not sure I see this ever being handed back. The government has long wanted more control over admissions, which is strange for a government that claims to believe in a free market. They also feel like there are good and bad courses, that somehow all of this information in the market is not able to identify, and students keep applying to do stuff that they want to do.
And I mean, that this set of contradictions, I mean, I think my favourite thing in the press release, there's a moment where, you know, effectively DfE jump on this thing about incentives and say somewhere in the press release, you know, this giving out inappropriate incentives, like, you know, dangling iPads in front of people as an incentive to come would obviously not be allowed anymore. You know, the sort of thing we've seen in the press a lot. Two bullet points apart, the press release says, oh, well, we're very pleased to say that, you know, poorer students will be able to have a laptop bought for them out of the student premium funding that OFS allocates. And it's like, so, hold on. So laptops are bad, but laptops are essential. And if ever there was a moment where you've got the kind of ultimate contradiction between the way in which different people will read and interpret some of these behaviours in a market with, you know, incentives and competition, it would be that.
I think can I say just two rejoinders to Debbie and DK? One is that I think that it's possible that the kind of the bargain has been done. So, I mean, it is a sacrifice of autonomy in return for just that baseline stability for the next few months. And, you know, you're not going to see the university representative bodies today pushing back really hard on this consultation and on the proposal. They've been happy to cooperate with the moratorium up to now, completely on a voluntary basis, on the understanding that the government was working on, you know, some more of the carrot. And I think essentially that deal's been done. And as for the free market, I think that could be finished. You know, DK, you said that the government believes in free market, and in normal times I'd agree with you, but the whole economy has changed. The whole nature of this government and its purpose has changed. And I no longer think that free market economics is the underlying driver for a lot of decisions. And coming out of the pandemic, I think we'll see, you know, large parts of the economy nationalized, for example. And a lot of market theory that the system was built on will essentially collapse. And that what will be interesting for all of us is kind of coming up with a way of, you know, funding higher education, delivering a higher education system after all of that has been completely reconfigured. I don't even think the government has a clear ideological sense of what it's going to want to achieve after we start rebuilding. But that's certainly a movable feast.
Now, let's have a think about students for a minute. So first of all, can someone remind me, what is in here for students financially, if anything?
You've got the possibility of a share of a £46 million extra money into hardship funds coming.
It's not extra money. It's not extra money, though, is it?
It's not extra money because it already exists.
That's right.
And if you wanted to talk it up, that comes to a little over £25 for every student that's currently in English HE.
I mean, the point being that there's probably still more students in financial hardship than are going to be served by this £46 million.
Yeah, indeed. It's not much money. It's not much extra money. The other thing we have to... that is conspicuous by its absence here is the many campaigns for partial or complete student fee refunds.
Yeah,
it's still entirely possible students could make these claims, and as we saw OIA annual report last week, there is the possibility that they could look kindly on such claims. This is another potential huge impact on individual providers. and there's no money at all in there to deal with that. So if you're a student looking for a bailout, it looks like your choice is you can ask for a fee refund, or you can have a university next year. I mean, choose one.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really funny bit in the OFS consultation, which says what you mustn't do is tell lies about what other people are offering in relation to, you know, like online teaching and stuff. And I was thinking, yeah, that's fine, but how do you tell the truth about what you're offering in relation to September? Because I'm not sure anyone knows what they're offering in relation to September yet, do they?
Indeed not. I mean, I've been talking to a bunch of academics, and although I have to say they've done a fantastic job in shifting a lot of teaching online, and some of that online move is of really, really high quality. The vast majority of it is emergency learning. It is the last resort. It's what they've managed to track together in a couple of weeks. That's fine for this term, but it is not something that they could realistically say to students next term, this is what we're offering. It's not the same as the fully automated luxury online learning, if you will, that you would get from the Open University or Birkbeck.
As I say, I think this speaks to the kind of problem of not taking a kind of system level approach. Because I mean, one of the things that, for example, Universities UK asked for, and this speaks to, you know, the Gavin Williamson's thing about you know, universities serving their place. Universities UK actually said, and this was, I mean, presumably a political calculation, but a sensible one, to say, make a fund available for a, you know, thinking about the future of universities, thinking about restructures, maybe mergers, you know, thinking about how universities can kind of best serve society going forward. Now, from the conversations I've been having as part of a piece of work that we're going to be launching later in the week, you know, be talking to kind of sort of senior people, particularly on boards and involved in kind of sector level kind of support for governors. And, you know, the appetite is absolutely there to think about how do we not, you know, rethink the entire of higher education, but, you know, think again about what more could be done to better, you know, to serve the needs of society in a post-COVID world. And by putting in, you know, by not kind of thinking about that bigger picture and about the kind of some of the kind of bigger possibilities for significant change, you know, for example, you know, good example, moving everything online, there's lots and lots of opportunities there to you know, to do things differently and do them in an interesting way if it is thought through and it is done carefully and it is kind of, and the kind of balance is struck between serving the needs of a student population that wants to study face to face versus, you know, the bigger picture, but doing things in a kind of piecemeal, drip, you know, individual institutions where they fall into financial issues, we will, look at the situation in that particular context kind of way, really does miss an opportunity to, in some ways, achieve all the things that the government's been agitating about and that we saw in the Ogre Review and that sort of thing.
But just on that, isn't it amazing that we've got a whole bunch of, you know, we've got a relatively, you know, kind of fleshed out proposal here from government. We've got a significant intervention from the regulator of higher education in England. None of it talks about what may or may not actually get delivered in September. None of it talks about whether or not, you know, we really ought to delay for a whole term. None of it talks about, you know, when universities may open or not open. None of it talks about online learning. None of it talks about students. It's extraordinary the extent to which it doesn't really talk about the things that students are and academic staff are talking about.
Well, you know, from the government's end, you know, it has to kind of it's on until it's not, like the rest of like the rest of the economy. And they don't, I guess, from their perspective, they don't want to shake confidence in the HE system and start creating even more uncertainty in terms of particularly what applicants are going to do, and also or incentivize universities not to be geared up to starting in September, if that is at all possible.
But this is the great question, isn't it? Because for loads and loads and loads of both first year students and continuing students, that they owe their landlord rent money, some from June the 1st, some from July the 1st, some from September the 1st. So the ones where, you know, the money's due on June the 1st, would you pay everyone at this point? I'm not sure I would.
Depends how badly I wanted to get away from my parents, or depends how badly I kind of... I hope that would be possible. I mean, yeah, it's a complicated calculation.
And it's a month away.
I'm an inveterate follower of the rules, so I would pay. But that's a dispositional thing, not a kind of calculated thing.
Yeah. Now, DK, tell us about Clearing Plus.
Oh, Clearing Plus. Now, this is cropped up in the bailout, not a bailout package, and I have no idea why it is there. For what I can tell, it's something that...
it's the third UCAS, bullet point.
Yeah, it's something that, I mean, UCAS were planning to do anyway, which is to give kind of better support to people that are entering clearing, that are not holding a firm acceptance in July, a firm offer, sorry, in July. It just, I mean, rather than saying, okay, here's all the universities and courses in the world, take your pick, they're actually going to give students a little list of courses that might suit them. So if you're applying to do, say, politics and you haven't got any of your, and you haven't got any offers from the places you applied, it would suggest some other places that you might want to look at that, kind of doing politics that would fit your expected grade. Now, this is what UCAS are saying, clearing classes. But what DfE are saying, clearing classes, a personalised service, and that's going to be absolutely ringing massive alarm bells for anybody with any involvement in edtech. It's a new service which matches students to universities or other opportunities based on their achievements and course interests. If a student's calculated grades, that's their actual A-levels this year, exceed their predicted ones, it can suggest alternative courses with higher entry requirements. Now, as far as I can tell from the UCAS press release, it's not going to do that unless an applicant decides to release their firm offer if they get higher grades and enter the world of self-release and adjustment. Now, it's a little bit like a version of Tinder, where in order to see your matches, you need to be absolutely sure that you've broken up with your current partner. Think that the idea of students thinking that there have been some courses specifically selected that they might get on, but they have to let go of their existing offer. That's kind of slightly peculiar. And although it's going to help students entering clearing without an offer, I'm not sure what it's doing in this bailout.
So let me get this right. So if you say, if you do better in this new A-level result thing they're creating than you kind of thought, and better than the sorts of universities you applied to in terms of tariff points, you can release yourself, and then the computer will tell you what you could have won. Is that right?
Something like that, yeah. I think you're grasping for the idea of a game show format is a lot safer than my metaphor.
Okay, can I make a pitch for the rationale here? Because I think I see it. So, If this was kind of pure tech, you know, if this was sort of designed by tech bros, shall we say, then it would be very much kind of like, are you sure this is your choice? But, you know, think of all these other things you could have won. I don't think that's what's going on here. I think UCAS is saying, students who, for whatever reason, have rethought their offer should need some kind of help to think through what their alternatives might be. Because at the end of the day, if you've chosen your university, you're happy with that choice, even if you have, you know, in heavy quote marks, you know, grades that are, you know, above the university that you've landed with, then why would you need to see the alternatives, you know? And I don't think, and in some ways it's really not helpful to be kind of trying to nudge those students. If, however, you have decided that is not the university for you for whatever reason, then having a kind of selection of possibilities seems like it would make quite a lot of sense, as opposed to having, you know, the entire kind of gamut of every university and every clearing course. I think possibly UCAS is thinking through this in a kind of student-centered way. What I think is that the government is now turning this into a kind of what we know. What is
has anyone got anything to put in the press release? Yeah.
The perennial problem of, you know, of students kind of making horrifying choices that are not in their best interests, if the only thing that you think the student's interest is getting to the most prestigious university possible, which is, of course, not always in students' best interests.
Yeah, because two things strike me. So one, the tariff points are explicitly not in the TEF. You know, we don't, in theory, have a government that says tariff points are the determiner of best or quality. We actually have a series of other things that are supposed to point that out. And also, surely this would make sense in a year where there weren't number controls rather than when there were. Because if you suddenly got number controls, it's half a risk to release yourself, isn't it?
It is literally adding more uncertainty into the system. I mean, that is what it's doing.
But I mean, self-release existed last year. This was a new thing. It was tried in 2019. A proportion of students, what was it, 10,000 students?
It was about 26,000-ish.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, maybe it was 10% then, something like that, but or 5%. Anyway, a number of students find it useful. And of course, that is in the student interest, because why would you have to, you should not have to wait for your university to release you before you kind of go off and make other sorts of decisions. So I think, this was, some of the stuff was on the roadmap anyway. Rather like GFE's plans to buy up university buildings and convert them into schools or for other projects, mysterious other projects. This is a number of things that have been put in to kind of generally give reassurance and a sense that things are being done.
So look, Mark, before we wrap this up and get some sleep and put various finishing touches to blogs, there's lots of coverage of various aspects of this on the site this morning. Just talk to us for a minute about the kind of framing of all this and the politics and where this might go next.
So I think that we talked about this on last week's podcast. Justin Trudeau got this really, really right a couple of weeks ago with a massive package to support Canadian universities, but starting with the interests of students. And I think one of the kind of neatest things about that was how it showed the power and importance of higher education centered around the people who experience it and benefit it from it. And one of the kind of habits we have in this country is always talking about higher education from a kind of supply side rather than the demand side, if you kind of want to use economic terms. And what this does, I think, is a really pernicious thing, which is kind of separate out universities from the people who benefit from them. The students that go primarily, but also the communities and local regional economies and so many, that depend on the sector in so many different ways, as we talk about a lot on Wonky. And I think one of the really dispiriting things is to see a kind of essentially a continuation of that trend in this kind of moment of maximum national tragedy, danger, crisis. Everyone's paying attention, that everyone is watching, to not use this as an opportunity to kind of frame really positively, the importance and power of universities, starting, as I say, with the people who benefit from them, the students being almost completely absent, as we've talked about, from this bailout proposal. As I say, total missed opportunity and I think a serious long-term problem. I also think, possibly less generously, even more cynical than that, DK mentioned the 2.6 billion looks very similar to last week's 2.5 billion. The 2.5 billion was a hole that we expect to see in the sector's budget next year. And the government's announcing 2.6 billion. It's not new money. And we talked about this. I just want to reiterate, it's not new money. It's just money brought forward that the sector was going to get, already. It just seems to me, and we haven't seen Monday's papers yet, but it seems to me that government is going for a kind of quick headline. 2.6 billion looks like, that's fair cop. Universities, not sure, how much we should be really supporting them these days. As a person on the street, just look at the comments under any national newspaper article about higher education and bailouts over the last couple of weeks, and you'll see all of those kind of concerns writ large. Speak to your friends and family over the next couple of weeks, and they'll say, "Oh yeah, I heard those universities, they're getting, what was it, £2-4 billion? That sounds good." No, the government isn't providing new money, and the people who are kind of at the sharpest end of this, most kind of exposed and most peril, are getting absolutely nothing at all. So I think there's something fairly cynical going on there, and I also think it's a real missed opportunity. What I think one of the most interesting things about this whole package does tell us, though, is that the government will also know that it needs to approach this on a provider-by-provider basis, not just because it clearly can't agree on a big political package, but also, I think, because of the kind of the local politics. The last general election, the much-discussed red wall broke, and there are now a bunch of new Tory MPs representing seats with universities in them, many in the North and the Midlands. Those MPs would be absolutely crazy to want to see a university fail on their watch, as would a government want to see any university fail. So I guess what we have to pin our hopes on now are regional deals and regional politics slanted in the sector's favour, in that the governing party, being the Tory party, and there being so many new Tory MPs with major universities in their seats, coming together to make sure that individual universities don't fall over. But we would have missed a massive opportunity to tell everyone in the country about why we all need to club together to save our most precious institutions. I think it's a real pity.
So that's about it for this special edition. Remember to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Apple Podcasts or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or you'll find the feeds you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Mark and Debbie and DK, everyone else at Team Wonky for making it all happen behind the scenes. And until next week, stay wonky.